players as well as composers are falling in love with our instrument, the sound that we can produce, the traditional sound, and also the more avant-garde sounds of sound effects and so forth. We're constantly trying to improve the bass.
Yeah.
We have 5 strings, we have 4 strings, we have 3 or 4 different tunings, we have 2 bows, we have this and that. A lot of people still experimenting with what works best, including the makers.
Yes,
they're
yes,
trying
so many
different
shapes,
styles,
right?
Shapes, and string lengths and all of that. So we're really interested in getting better.
Hello everyone, my name is Dominik Wagner and today I'm here in Vienna with the double bass legend, Jeff Breditich. Jeff, thank you so much for being here, for taking the time to talking to me. Because you know, you obviously know, I love music, I love the bass, and I love talking about music and the bass, sharing ideas about maybe a possible future for our instrument or for the music scene in general, what we can do to influence that, and especially when it's about influencing the bass scene. I mean, I don't think there are many people who have managed to accomplish as much as you did over the last decades.
Well, you're very kind, and it's a great pleasure to be here and to visit with you. And I can say the same for you already as a very young person. You're already pushing the boundaries of classical bass and bridging into other types of ensembles and opportunity for our instrument. Obviously, we're known as orchestral instrument or the jazz instrument, but our music has now branched well out of classical music into what we call crossover, and picking up many different styles and experimentation. And the reason this is happening is because players as well as composers are falling in love with our instrument, the sound that we can produce, the traditional sound, and also the more avant-garde sounds of sound effects and so forth. And a lot of this, if I can say, is really stems from the fine teaching that has been going on more and more on the younger level.
Absolutely.
So we're turning out more and more better educated and more highly trained people coming into the university and the college conservatory age. And
absolutely.
Then,
you know, I think that's what happened to the cello also, because currently one might even say there are more really top young cellists than young violinists. Because since I would say that the big boom was kind of probably caused by Rostropovich and all his students, and now there are so many top level teachers. And if you look at the big cello competitions, the level is ridiculous.
Yeah.
But we see it also with the bass. It's rising and rising. And I am even happy now that I am already done with the competition part, because some of the young players now.
Oh, I know.
There's one thing though I really want to ask you, because you know, for me it was easy to get the idea of the bass, of becoming a musician. You just go online and you see what's out there. And for me, the kind of your, so to say, origin story would be interesting to know, because what gave you the idea, of becoming a musician or maybe a bassist, or then, you know, even not just any kind of bassist, but a bassist that really pushed this instrument forward as a solo instrument. Like, how did you get that idea?
It's a good question. I'm not sure. But I began very young on the bass, but I grew up in a family of, my mother was a singer and her mother was a singer, my grandmother. So I constantly had that type of musical experience. I used to go to lots of concerts, not necessarily wanting to as a child, but I was dragged there. How much longer?
Yeah.
But I heard the great music, I heard the great singers, and then I played professionally in opera. So I heard Pavarotti and Dominguez and Carreras and all the greats of the time, and I really tried to incorporate a lot of that into my own playing. It just spoke to me on a very deep level. But, you know, I think part of what has happened for me is that I just began to explore the instrument.
Yeah.
And then in my day, when I was growing up, there were two LP recordings of solo double bass.
Two.
That's it. And now today you can turn on the YouTube and you can get thousands of things. Any high school kid in the world puts his best piece on there. But in my day, there were two LPs. And the reason there were so few, partly is the bass wasn't considered a solo instrument, but also you had to get to one of the big companies to get recorded. You couldn't just do your own recording and put it out on YouTube. It didn't exist. And what's interesting, with those two recordings, one was groundbreaking, Gary Carr, and the other one, as a ninth grader, when I was 15, I go, oh, I can do better than that. I was 15. And I, you know, not egotistically, it's just that that was the standard. It wasn't terribly high. And
just out of curiosity, what was in the Gary Carr recording? What pieces do you remember?
Well, his landmark recording of the Eccles Sonata, Paganini Moses Fantasy, the Bloch Prayer, and the Ravel Habanera, that was outstanding as well. But so as I got to play the bass more and got involved in more traditional chamber music and things like this, other composers and people began to get interested in our instrument. And that's where I think the bass is today, is it's happening on a much greater level, say, than the violin. The violin has had its greatest players. It's all this fabulous repertoire. It doesn't have a lot of room
to grow. Where is it supposed to go? Absolutely.
And we do. We still have a lot of ways we can go in the traditional classical world. But then when you start adding in the jazz influence and the crossover and all these different styles, world music works really well on our instrument as well. So that the sky is still the limit. It's interesting because we're constantly trying to improve the bass.
Yeah.
We have five strings. We have four strings. We have three or four different tunings. We have two bows. We have this and that. A lot of people still experimenting with what works best, including the makers.
Yes.
They're trying different styles, shapes, and string lengths and all of that. So we're really interested in getting better. And from the more traditional classical side, the one thing that has helped us tremendously, and it's been much more prevalent in America and in the U.S. than it has been in Europe, and I've been beating my head on this in Europe for some time, and it's starting to change, but very slowly, is the playing of the Bach cello suites.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're becoming more commonly played by people like yourself and so forth, but I used to come to Europe and play, and I would play them or work on them in master classes and things like that. And people were like, well, no, this is not written for us. It's, you know, that's not the point. The point is it's great music and it's incredibly challenging to play something written for an instrument tuned in fifths, to play it then on a bass that's tuned in fourths and try to get the same idea that the composer's getting across. Students are studying it today and it's pushing their understanding of technique. We've had to invent new finger patterns and new ways of manipulating our fingers on the fingerboard that the traditional repertoire does not call for.
Absolutely.
So if we weren't expanding, I mean, one area that I've always been a big fan of and have transcribed over 100 different pieces for bass is transcriptions. If it's a great piece of music, I go, wow, that's wonderful. You know, let's see if it works on the bass. You have to be humble and say, maybe it doesn't.
Yeah,
and if it doesn't, okay, we'll put it away and go on to the next piece.
That's the same for me. You know, I mean, you probably know very well. I mean, back in the when I did the Bratisic competition, I did a lot of my own arrangements and transcriptions
and your own compositions.
I love this, listening to many pieces, and I would like to play everything on the bass, but I also have to learn. You know, okay, this maybe just doesn't work, but. But it's quite impressive sometimes what can actually work. And, you know, with the Bach suites, that's what I find so fascinating. It's one thing to just say, okay, I just want to make something sound good on the bass. But the big, big thing we can learn from that, which especially as bassists, I think we should know, is, you know, in the Bach suites, there aren't really melodies. It's just scales and arpeggios, basically. That's it. And so we have to really understand harmony.
Right, how the harmony moves the line.
Absolutely, like what is a, like a tension, what is relaxation, and so on and so forth. And that's why it's so smart that people play the Bach suites, because what do we do in the orchestra? We don't play the melodies, or rarely. We have to, with our bass lines, show where is the goal, where do we go away from, where is tension, and so on. So we need to understand harmony. And also, that's something I liked now, that's something I should take away for the listeners or viewers. Just before this, Jeff did an incredible masterclass with some students of mine, and definitely one of the best masterclasses I've ever listened to, I have to say. I still am really impressed. And that's something I really like that you do, that a lot of bassists are not yet aware of, that the harmony, even if you have a piece with melody, that shows what's really important. That's always the main thing.
Absolutely. I'm always talking to the student about, here the music is getting more intense. Well, they can't tell that because they're playing one note written on the page. Where's the tension coming from? The harmony, which is in the piano at this point, or in the other instruments in an ensemble. So knowing what is going on in the piano and the piece in general will dictate the direction that the music needs to go. And that's something that, of course, we all have to learn how to do. But generally, you know, when you think of teaching and a student, they're learning how to hold the instrument and play it and so forth. As you know, and we can talk about later, I wrote a book about the double bass, how to play it, how to perform, how to practice. And I called it Double Bass, the Ultimate Challenge.
Yes.
And everybody's going, what does that mean? Well, think about it for a second. You are having to do so many different things at one time, one of which is just holding the instrument, balancing the instrument, putting the hands in the right shape, in the right place. And then you have this black dot on a piece of paper, and you have to interpret that black dot into, it tells you where to play your finger, maybe what finger to play, tells you the rhythm. And then you have to do that in connection with the people around you. And then you have to, at the same time, follow the conductor over there. And at the same time, you have to come from here and put something out there that the listener will hopefully feel and understand. And raise them up in their own life. I mean, how many different balls is that we're having to juggle at one time? Sometimes as many as 10.
Yeah.
And absolutely. I can't think of another activity. I want your listeners to think right now of another activity that you do in a day's time that requires you to juggle 10 balls at once. There's nothing. I mean, it's a little bit like a computer, except all you have to do is hit one key. The computer's doing all the other connections. But when we're playing our instrument, and again, because of the size and some of the difficulty factors, it is a bigger challenge than the other instruments, the other string instruments. They're not easy. I'm not suggesting that at all. It takes great skill to play on a high level. But we have probably the biggest challenge in front of us. And on top of that, we have the kind of the psychological factor of, well, the bass isn't a solo instrument.
Yes.
Why are you playing solos on the bass?
Yeah, that's something I really want to talk to you about is, you know, what you did is really push the bass as a solo instrument, as a performer on the one hand, as an arranger, but also then you organized competitions, you organized festivals and
conventions.
And also as a teacher, you brought forward a lot of incredible players. So what gave you the idea to really go for the bass as a solo instrument? Was it the recordings? Because for me, it was recordings online. I watched your recordings, or Ibagimov, or whatever, Alex Lewis, and so on. That inspired me. But
well, like I said, we didn't really have many.
Yeah.
And the few that we had then were all the, you know, you listen to them now and you go, wow, the recording quality is not so great compared to today. But for us, we didn't know any different. But I was very fortunate to, of course, grow up in a singing family. And then I studied with a cellist when I was young, because the bass teacher in town could only take me this far and he couldn't take me further. And so he passed me on to the cello professor.
So you started with the bass teacher, and after a certain amount of time, you just noticed, okay.
He said, that's all I can do. And so he sent me up to the cello professor,
nice,
who knew some double bass, but he would have me play the Saint-Saëns cello concerto and the Boccherini cello sonata and things like that. And you know, I'd have to figure it out.
Yeah.
But he expected the same things of me that he did of his cello students.
So you had to...
So I didn't know any different.
Already back then, how old were you when you started with a cello teacher?
15 to 18.
And you had to, back then, yourself already figure out how to arrange the pieces, how to make them work on the bass.
Yeah, just fingerings, obviously. And he taught me certain skills that have, actually, that I'm still trying to teach the bass world, that the bass world has been a little reluctant to go there, but they will over time. And a certain, you know, use of the fingers that most bass players just use large muscles when they play and don't get down to the refined muscles that control the refined aspects of playing, string crossing and absorption of shock in the hand, these types of things. And thumb position. Now, any advanced bass player today plays thumb position all over the instrument because we can and because we have to. But in that day, I mean, you played traditional thumb on the harmonics and you didn't move out of that position. Dragonetti Concerto, for instance. And it was very much a limitation. So I was faced with this limitation, but I had in my ear the singing quality of my mother and grandmother and just my own nature, and tried to find a way of matching the two together.
So it was basically playing the bass, having a cello teacher, and having the singing influence.
Yes.
Because the singing, that is to me so interesting. That is, you know, I know in the arrangements that you made and in the repertoire that you recorded and also published, there's a big focus on the singing aspect of the bass, which is also a big thing for me because I got my main musical influence as a teenager from singing also when I was back in the Vienna Boys Choir.
Oh, right, of course.
And I think, and also I saw that now when you were teaching, you were singing a lot because it is just the most natural approach. Mm. So you think that clearly influenced your playing as well when growing up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I see it today when I choose pieces that I want to play or I want to transcribe. And now I've been able to have published a two-volume set of singing pieces, great repertoire that sounds great on the bass. Why not? And I look back at history, and Heifetz transcribed pieces all the time for the violin, and yet they had all this great repertoire. They were still looking for new ways to find expression. And then later, the cello, Pietragorsky, transcribed lots of music for the cello, and yet they had Dvorak and Haydn and Schumann and Tchaikovsky, you know, so forth.
I have the feeling it was just a different time, like this kind of exploration aspect was a part of it for the cellists and violinists back then. Because back then also they didn't have like the technical system that everyone learns and the highest level possible achieved. It was still a time of trying new things, and that's what I think is so cool. We have basses in all sizes and shapes, and we do this exploring. How can we expand the repertoire by, you know, new arrangements, but also... That's something I also want to ask you. Like, for me, there are two main ways to expand repertoire, either arranging or commissioning contemporary music. Especially there, I think the bass, because of really finding out with its size, what effects can you do? What are the things that are actually possible to achieve? Did you do a lot of that also, like overall? Or it would also be interesting for me to hear the difference between the European and American bass scene. Is there a lot of contemporary music being pushed there as well?
It is in our modern day, but it really reaches back to a very active performer when I was young, and his name is Bert Turetsky. He commissioned over 300 solo pieces for double bass.
Crazy.
And some duos and things like that. And it's an incredibly wide range of repertoire. And his pushing and getting composers to listen to the bass and say, wow, I like the traditional sound, but listen to all these sound effects, listen to these different sounds, exploring what can be done, pushing the envelope, pushing them, and then trying to sell it to audiences as well. And then from that came that whole series of theater pieces that were very popular, and I've done quite a few by John Deake, especially.
His
Big Bad Wolf is one of the great pieces I think ever written. And it's a, you know, it's a boom, 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 boom And then you speak and act as well as play traditional and contemporary styles. It was, you know, again, pushing the outside of the envelope of what the bass can do. That inspired this composer to move on to this and so forth. And then great players come along like Edgar Meyer, who did the crossover style and really brought a whole new flavor to what the bass can do and do well. So yeah, a lot is going on. People are experimenting all the time, and a lot of composers, a lot of young people composing, which is great to see. And I know it's happening a lot in Europe as well. So,
and I think that speaks like well for one our future. Of the main things we need to do if we want to push the bass as a solo instrument. Because, I mean, you probably know this as well as I do. It works in the concert. The audiences love it. They're so curious to hear it. And they're always, because you have this element of surprise. They haven't heard it a million times yet.
They don't know what to expect.
Exactly. And also, you know, maybe they don't want to hear the 100th Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto, even though it's great. But then with the bass, having a new instrument, with new pieces that maybe have an even added interest to it, because it's maybe not only just the new language of the bass, but also the new language of a new exciting composer combined.
Yeah. Well, I've surreptitiously done a little research.
Okay.
When I go to a premiere of a double bass concerto,
yeah,
and I'm sitting in the audience, and I'll look around and see how people are reacting, if they're falling asleep or if they're, well, you know, like this. And so I'll go up to some of these people afterwards and I'll say, you know, so, you know, I don't, you know, I'm so-and-so, and just tell me, what'd you think of that bass thing? He says, you know, I had no idea. That was really great.
Nice.
And I remember I played a concerto with an orchestra, and they came to me after the season. They said, our audience said that you, well, that was the most enjoyable piece that they heard all year long, and that was the new concerto by Andres Martin.
Ooh, fantastic.
Who's another style of just sweeping South American harmonies and melodies and bringing a whole nother side to our music. So.
An incredibly emotional music, especially. I think he is the reason why I was able to, back in the day, win the Veritage competition. Mm,
yeah.
Because, I mean,
you played his concerto.
The others played incredible. I wouldn't say I'm a better bassist at all, but I had a much better piece. and the piece, you know, his music, if you play that well, if you feel it. And I think that's what you said also earlier. You want to tell a story. You want to make the audience feel something, not just some intellectual thing on stage.
Yeah, or a show, you know.
Exactly. But you want to make them experience a story and feel emotions. And that's where his music obviously really strikes a point.
And it's important that we're talking about this. I want to shed some light on the other side of the subject where we didn't get the piece.
Oh.
And there's been, unfortunately, too many of these throughout history.
Yeah.
And the primary one was the Haydn Double Bass Concerto, which we're hoping is still hiding here in Europe.
I'm currently in contact with some people that might, maybe, but probably will not.
Perhaps Esterhazy, perhaps in St. Petersburg. We know it was played. We know it exists. We just only had the first two bars of it. And if we'd had that throughout history, might other composers have used that as inspiration? Probably so. But then you came to someone like Bottesini in the latter part of the 19th century, middle and later. Greatest virtuoso in the world, said to be greater than Paganini. And yet there's not a single composer that wrote him a piece during this time period. Now, he influenced Verdi, so we had two double bass solos in our operas.
But, you know, I thought a long time about that. And I think I read a bit about the period, quite a bit about the whole period. And I think the reason is also why Verdi didn't write like symphonies or stuff like that. This Italian scene was completely separated from the symphonic scene. So like Italian music, there was the opera and the virtuosic pieces. And even when Bottesini, for example, wrote the string quartets and string quintet, that was already like looked down upon. It was one of these like German things, right?
Yes.
Exactly. And often they had then like Italian operas and the non-Italian operas and the rest of the world opera. And also the symphonic cycle and then the Italian cycle in a lot of places. Also when Bottesini played in London, he played in the Italian opera.
Yes.
And that is so sad because, it was, you know, but we feel it often in music. Certain musicians in certain styles are like, no, this is the one true way, and others are like, no, this is the one true way. And that's why this world was kind of separated. If it hadn't been, I'm sure they would have all written for Wattasini.
Well, some other interesting circumstances like that was Brahms. His father was a bass player. Now, Brahms didn't once write for double bass in any of his chamber music. If I was his father, I would say, Johannes, I brought you into this world.
Now you write.
Now you write a piece for bass.
Yes.
Taking you out. So it was either that either they didn't get along, or his father was probably such a lousy bass player that Brahms just said, never. But anyway, that didn't work for anything for us. And then you come to Koussevitzky.
Yeah.
And he was the next well-known virtuoso that was championing the bass and eventually went into conducting and concert promotion. He was a big promoter in his Paris concerts before he ever went to America. And he knew, in fact, I think he's the greatest proponent of new music to have ever lived.
Probably, yeah.
Koussevitzky was commissioning Bartok and premiering Stravinsky and Prokofiev and Rachmaninoff. And when he came to America, Copland and Bernstein and
Ravel, when he was in Paris, that's something many people don't know, the orchestration of the pictures of an exhibition by Mussorgsky, the Ravel orchestration, that was commissioned and premiered by Koussevitzky.
And so here's this person who's in touch with all the great composers, promoting their new music. Couldn't we have gotten
some
piece, especially from Prokofiev, who knew the bass so well?
Or Bartok, could you imagine?
A Bartok bass concerto or sonata or even a short piece. To me, that was a lost opportunity.
Yeah.
Here was this person, and he just... I think he understood at that time that the bass just couldn't make it as a solo instrument or wasn't really built out to be it. So it didn't happen other than the Glier pieces, whose Glier is maybe not considered on the level of the others, but four good pieces.
Incredible. Yeah.
So it wasn't until 1949 that Paul Hindemith writes a sonata for the double bass that a really recognized great composer writes something soloistic for the bass. Since, all the way back to Rossini's duetto for Dragonetti in 1824. That's
wow.
125-year black hole in our solo repertoire, yet we had the greatest player, we had the greatest proponent, and we still couldn't break through. And I attribute part of that to exactly what you said and kind of the tradition of the day, the bass wasn't a solo instrument, but also to the level of playing and sound.
Absolutely.
And what was explored, what was taught, and now that that has changed, and I mean, you know, in my circle, people just expect bass players to play solo.
Wow, that's fantastic.
And, you know,
it's not yet the overall opinion in the music scene, but it hopefully will be.
But anyway, those are some of the could-have-beens, would-have-been, should-have-beens. But even in our day now, the International Society of Bassists commissioned Hina Stera to write a bass concerto back in the 1970s. Gave him, I think it was $15,000. When they raised the money and said, Maestro, we now have $15,000 that you agreed to write this bass concerto, he said, my fee's now $25,000. And so it didn't happen. And then Ludoslavsky.
Yeah.
I mean, Klaus Stoll of the Berlin Philharmonic told me, Ludoslavsky's writing us a bass concerto, and I think he was going to premiere it in 1988. And there's been some others along the way where we almost didn't quite.
Yeah.
But finally, that is beginning to break, and composers are getting brave enough to write for us. And
you know, the weird thing is composers actually are often really interested. Like most of the contemporary composers I talk to, even like the really big names, they are absolutely open and interested. The question is, can we get the money, which is often the top composers a lot, and can we then get multiple really big opportunities to premiere it? You know, if... Like the big composers, they expect the pieces to be premiered with Berlin Phil, you know?
Right.
And is that something as a mere mortal double bassist you can make happen? Obviously, the name of the big composer helps in getting the big orchestras, but it's still the bass.
Yep.
So that's a big limitation that we have there. Although, you know, if you look back in the past, we see even Beethoven, for example, he played the sonatas with Dragonetti on the bass, and he was apparently incredibly happy with that, and That's why probably the bass parts got so incredibly difficult.
And he gave a little solo quality to the bass.
Absolutely.
Obviously in the fifth and ninth.
In the ninth, I'm sure we would not have that if it wasn't for Dragonetti. Just like we wouldn't have the Verdi solos if it wasn't for Bottesini.
So there's certainly some influence there, and we did get some great chamber music out of that turn of the century, from the Dvorak Quintet up through Prokofiev and Stravinsky, L'Histoire du Soldat, and many other pieces.
Yeah, so it's probably just we need to make the opportunities happen. And that's something that, now we come to one thing you do, your foundation, the Bratetic Foundation, which hosts a competition. Also, there's many, many other things helped me a lot in my career. Also gave me a lot of performance opportunities, which then led to new premieres. For example, last year, your foundation organized a US tour for me.
Yes.
And part of that was a recital in Carnegie Hall. And part of the program was a premiere by a new piece of Andres Martin. So I think
with
that
the composer
is,
on stage with
the
you.
Composer
even
on stage.
Great, even better.
Yeah, so I think that is a big thing. Getting the bass the opportunity to go into the spotlight. Because then once you say, oh, I have a performance opportunity there, there, and there.
Right, then it can happen. We haven't talked too much about the teaching, but I grew up in a teaching family. I grew up in a singing family. So
your parents were also teaching singing?
Other subjects, but they were teachers just in general. But so the teaching and the playing, and I've championed those my whole career, which extends over 40 some odd years now. But there's another aspect to what needed to happen and what still needs to happen and what I've been instrumental in helping, and that's bringing people together to learn. And when I was very young, when I was 25, I took over the directorship of the International Society of Bassists. And the first thing I did was say, okay, what do we need as a profession? We had a newsletter, so we turned that into a magazine where we got more and better articles written about our instrument that we could share with everybody around the world.
Still being shared today.
Long before computer. And the other thing I felt we really needed was getting the best people together to share what they do.
Yes.
And again, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have anything. Even LP recordings were very few. So I started by organizing conventions, which was not a common thing. And certainly on bass, it had never been done. So I organized the very first and the first four conventions for bass in 1984, 86, 88, and 1990. In 1984, I was in Chicago, and we held the first convention and brought people together. And you could hear what was going on in Europe and South America and Russia and so forth. And then this generated such interest in the bass world that it has just blossomed into a wonderful event every 2 years.
Exactly.
About 1,000 people or so attend every time.
That's the crazy thing. You started it. And today, that's one of the, or maybe even the biggest bass event every 2 years that exists, right?
For sure, yeah.
You started it.
Yes, and so I'm, you know, it's just part of my personality or my nature is to see what can be done and to organize in a way that promotes. And so I did a lot of that. I started the ISB solo competitions as well. Obviously, solo bass, classical and solo jazz, kind of not a particularly unique idea. But I also started Orchestral Excerpt Competition, which had never been done before in my knowledge in the entire world. Anybody had ever done an orchestra excerpt competition. So it was met with quite a bit of negativity, but so was the conventions, to be honest. I mean, who ever got together? What violins never got together for a convention? Cellists never got together. Violas never got together. So here we were in the bass world having a convention. And once people saw that, wow, that's really a great thing, then a lot of the other instruments started doing it. But same with the competition. Now that once I started the orchestral excerpt one, it grew finally and caught hold. And now everybody looks forward to doing it every 2 years. But other organizations and instruments are doing this in their conventions as well.
No, yes.
And it just promotes the you know, bringing the best together and giving them something to work for and be rewarded for.
And it creates a spirit, like the kind of the bass spirit in the US. And that's probably, yeah, a lot because of you. Oops. Because of you. And that's something I feel, and that's something I love whenever I'm in the US. The spirit of the bass is the interest, the openness to what is going on in the world. What are different people doing? What are different people doing new? Mm. What might be a new great composition, a new great playing technique? You know, the people are so open and interested. I mean, I remember in the Carnegie Hall recital, there were 137 double bassists listening. That's unimaginable for anywhere else in the world.
Some of them came from 8 hours away driving just to hear your concert. So.
And the new composition and the new arrangements and that stuff. And that to me is incredible. So was this kind of spirit, this interest, did you feel it was already there back when you started with the convention, or is that kind of what sparked it?
Well, I mean, there were enough people to make it happen. We had people, I think, from 9 countries, the first convention. This is in Chicago. I knew all the symphony players. I invited every single one of them to come to the convention and give a presentation. Every single one of them did. And that's the only thing they did. They didn't stay for anybody's concerts. They didn't stay for anybody's lectures. They were kind of like, what's this? We don't need it. Sure enough, about 8 years later, we're holding a convention in Indiana. And I'm just stunned to see 2 or 3 members of the Chicago Symphony coming, not just for one day, they're coming for the whole week.
Nice.
Because they realize, wow, this is really something cool. I'm learning things, and I'm in the top orchestra, one of the top orchestras, and I can learn things too. So it did begin to catch on, but like anything, it was, you know, you have to fight uphill. Same thing with solo bass.
You know,
we've been fighting this for years, and we'll continue to. But once I left the ISB and later I realized there were still things that needed to be done in our profession, and one of them was to bring the very best together into a competition we can hear, you know, bring the very best together and let the world hear how they play, what the bass sounds like, and give them opportunities such as the New York concert. So that's the primary focus of the foundation, and just, you know, building that opportunity for players as well as commissioning and getting new new solo pieces. And my next project will be to have the foundation act as a granting organization where people can come to us with ideas.
Uh-huh.
I think, you know, I've got this new innovation to do this, or I want to host an all female bass composers symposium, and that we would have money to support these events.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And I think that's kind of the next stage, that step that needs to happen.
Supporting new ideas and making them happen.
Yeah, because obviously I'm at the end of my career, towards the end of my career, and I don't have the energy to do all of it myself as I sort of did in the beginning. But if we can help the next person do their thing and make their contribution, and the next person, then that, of course, reaches a much greater end result.
To end this, I want to ask you one thing. We talk now a lot about the bass and about what we see in the future, how we want to, you know, change that, influence that. I also want to ask you in general about the future of classical music. Because that's something I feel often. People say classical music is dying. People are not listening to that anymore. Often I talk to, you know, people like taxi drivers that have no connection, and ask them, what do you think about classical music? And they often say, ah, oh, it's some elitist, fancy nonsense. I wouldn't go to a concert. I just feel it's too snobby for me. And they would go to a theater performance, but not to a classical concert, which I think is horrible. To me, classical music is something everyone can listen to. Everyone can be touched by it. And it has to offer such a huge variety of stories, of emotions that can be told through it. What do you think are like the main things that we need to focus on in the future to make classical music, well, sustain its audience, even maybe get a bigger audience? Like, what are the mistakes people do, and what do you think are things we can try to make better?
One of the biggest mistakes that does happen is that, no, we are a symphony orchestra and we're going to play Beethoven and Mozart, and if nobody comes, that's their fault. We're going to still do what we think, you know, this is. And the orchestras that are succeeding are reaching out in many different ways, from children's concerts to matinee concerts to targeting young yuppies, we used to call them, right? The young, upwardly mobile, single young people, to try to get them into the hall. Well, there's certain things. I mean, even just the simple task of childcare.
Yeah.
The husband and wife want to go to the symphony concert that night, but they can't get a babysitter. Mm. So what do? They stay at home and take care of the baby, and they don't get to go out. They don't get to experience it. And so there's all these sort of logistical things. But I don't know. I think still reaching people with the experience. In America, in 1994, we hosted the first time in America the World Cup for men's football, soccer.
Ah, okay.
And that was, you know, I mean, for America to do this, it had never been done before. We didn't have any real teams in America, but, you know, like professional teams, we really didn't have that. But after that happened, the young children started and continued and multiplied playing soccer.
Yeah.
And as they became teenagers, they became consumers of soccer. So they wanted to see it on TV. Well, that demand put soccer on TV. And with soccer on TV, more people saw it. More people began to appreciate it, because it was not appreciated in my country. Everybody's like, oh, it's too low scoring or whatever. You know, we want 60 to 45. Can you imagine in soccer? And so because of this youth, this young program, my children grew up in this movement.
Yeah.
When we moved to Texas, this was 30 years ago, there were, I think, 6 fields for soccer.
In Texas?
In my city.
In the city.
And what for the children. And once they finished high school, 10 years later, there was probably 60 fields. Wow. And because they needed them, and they had to have lights because people needed to play at night, because it wasn't time to get it done in the day.
So it went that quickly.
And it just grew exponentially. And I think if we can approach classical music a little bit that way too, is get the instruments in the hands of the kids. They love to play. They don't know what they're doing maybe to start with, but the act of doing is so tangible.
Yeah.
That I think it's something that stays with you in a way that sometimes if they just hear the sound, maybe it doesn't. But I also know teachers that in the first grade class, these little 6-year-olds come into their class and they have Vivaldi 4 Seasons playing. And the teacher writes on the board, this is Vivaldi's 4 Seasons. That's all. The kid goes, oh, cool, great. Mm-hmm. You know, or I used to go out, and a number of people have gone out and do children's concerts.
Yes, I do that also
say,
a lot. Yeah.
This is the bass. And the bass is really cool because of this, that. And the kids go, oh, I love the bass. Oh, it's fantastic. So when they go home and they're going to become consumers.
Yes.
And when they say, oh, a bass concert. Oh, I heard the bass played once. It was so much fun.
I will go to that because I heard it.
So I've kind of touched on a lot of different things. I don't think there's one answer, but I think...
Of course, there are many things, but that is probably the biggest. Making sure you make it approachable and interesting to people when they're really young, so that they have it in their mind that, oh, that's something I can do. It's something normal. It's not something too high and mighty, something that's so intellectual. It's something that's fun to listen to, that's nice to, that's something that I can enjoy.
And what I find interesting in terms of the future of classical music is how popular opera has become.
Yeah.
Much more so in my country. I don't know. I mean, it's always been popular in Europe, obviously. But operas are selling out and the seasons are expanding and things like this. And it's because people want stories.
Yeah.
They want to understand the nature of human emotion and life. And it's told in bold colors and sounds right there on the opera stage.
That's why it's probably so important to also engage the audience in a dialogue, to talk to them, to explain them maybe a personal connection to a piece, tell them, okay, or it's about this, this is, these are the characters, maybe if it's a piece that tells a certain story, make it easier and more approachable for them, like also with words, so that they can then, when they listen to the music, feel an even stronger connection to it, which obviously in opera, since you combine the words already with
right.
that.
another thing that good friend of mine does is she invites a friend of hers to every one of the orchestra concerts during the year, and that person goes, whoa, I enjoy this so much, I haven't been to a symphony before, it's fantastic. So we have to help get them in the door.
Yeah.
I mean, think of other things in life that you don't know anything about. Would you go out of your way to start doing it? I mean, without any connection or without a friendly pat on the shoulder or an invitation. So I think that there's a grassroots effort that needs to happen as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's just kind of overcoming this certain barrier of actually going there. Once you're there, it's the same with classical music yeah. as it is with the bass. Like with the organizers being afraid, does it work? Does it sound well in a big hall? Once they hear it, they're like, wow, sold. Yeah. Works. It's great. Same with classical music. It's somehow we need to overcome this barrier in any way we can and make it something that people actually are going to appreciate and enjoy.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me today. I hope this was also interesting for everyone who's listening and watching. At least for me, it was incredibly interesting talking to you, hearing many stories that I didn't know yet about the bass, many ideas I didn't know yet or didn't think about yet within the bass world, but also outside of the bass world. It's really a huge pleasure. Yeah, you're one of the reasons why I started the bass, your recordings.
Well, I appreciate that very much.
Thanks for doing what you are doing and for all the stuff you already did for the double bass world. The bass would not be what it is today without you.
It's awfully kind. Thank you.
Thank you.